Starbucks would have failed in Italy. But they didn't.
Hi, and welcome to Brand Matters Podcast. Here we discuss with our guest how to create strong and meaningful brands. Today, I have a very special guest, a CEO of a leading consulting company for the hospitality, retail, and food tech, and someone who helped me very much as an advisor and mentor when I became a CMO of the fastest growing pizza tech company. Today, I have with me Irina Orlandini-Abruzka. Ira, welcome.
Hi, Mishan. I'm very happy to be here. I'm very happy to be able to chat with you today.
When I was preparing for a podcast, I found the following description of yourself. You were born and raised in Moscow, studied in Canada and UK, worked for US companies for ages. You speak fluent French, obviously English. Your DNA test said you're Albanian, Italian, and Greek, but your parents believe that you're Jewish. And what you know for sure that almost all of your ancestors lived in the territory of Ukraine. And your husband is Italian-American, and daughter is Russian-Italian. And you live in Dubai. Wow! What a truly international background. So the first question to you is, how this international background helped you to become who you are right now?
I really understood myself as international as this description tells us. It just happened to all come together at some point, just like this. But since probably early ages of school, I was mostly interested in foreign languages and culture. And when I was about to finish school and everybody had to take exams and start different universities, I was like, I don't want to do that. I really don't care about math, history, anything. I really didn't care about anything but the languages and international environment and the culture. So probably this was the very beginning of my international career. And then I didn't stop. And then even before I finished my university, I went to study to Canada. And then I started working as an intern with international orchestras and ballet troupes. Believe me or not, that was my first profession working in performing arts. So I started working with those international celebrities like Van Cliburn, James Levine, Ubes Verbier Orchestra, Zubin Mehta, and whoever understands classical music, those are big names. So that was quite exciting at the time, but it was not exactly my industry. So at some point when I was, I think, 22, I landed in a restaurant group as a marketing director. And most of the founders of this restaurant group were Americans. It was in Russia. They were Americans. And they taught me a lot of things. And then I just followed up my career in the international companies as a marketing and business development for Papa John's, as brand director for TGI Fridays and Costa Coffee on different territories, different geographies. It was quite fun.
You have an amazing background on working with different food and restaurant brands, and especially in moving them into different countries or adjusting them to the countries where you worked. Let's talk about bringing food or restaurant brand to another market. For example, I want to take my hot dog stand from New York to, let's say, Dubai. How would I not screw up? Walk me through the process, please.
I strongly believe that every brand nowadays, unlike maybe 20 years ago, but nowadays, any brand moving from one territory to another has to adapt somehow to the market, because most of the markets are quite advanced. Consumer habits are very strongly rooted. There's different competition. There's different audience segments would communicate with your brand. So you really have to have some sort of adaptation. On the other hand, I believe that this adaptation has to be reasonable and doesn't have to ruin your business. So first of all, you have to stay core to your brand DNA and the very essence of what you're doing. And if you're moving international, I think you have to keep most of your technology intact. Because building an international and specifically a franchisable brand, what you're selling are the two things, basically, your brand. And not necessarily this brand is well known abroad. You may not be known, but there's something special about your brand that you're still able to sell to another market. And a second thing that you're selling is the technology. And most of the franchise chains are also making money on selling this technology to the franchisees. And that's quite clear. The technology is what keeps your franchisees with you and without leaving the brand and the network. And also a strong brand and a very interesting, unusual brand is something that keeps franchisees with you and doesn't let them build their own whatever. So those are the two things you have to care about before you start moving into international markets. And if you don't have a strong brand or package, I would say so, then this is the first thing you should think about doing before you start. And also, if your product is just a product, it's just a hot dog, right? So there's nothing special about your bun. It's not baked in a fantastic oven. It doesn't have a special recipe. And there's nothing special about the sausage. It's just a whatever hot dog thing. In my personal opinion, this is not going to work. So you have to have two solid blocks on this business. And then as you have your brand right, and then your technology right to move forward, then comes the adaptation process. So get to know the market very well, research the market, and of course, do explore it with the locals. With their knowledge, with their expertise, and understand what are the consumer demands and consumer habits in this particular market. Understand what is the competitive set. It's not going to be the same in every market. And even the positioning of the brand is not going to be the same. So in some brands, let's say Domino's is positioned as a discounter. In others, is positioned as a premium. That's fine. As long as it's the same brand that communicates speed, efficiency, and things like that, and simplicity, things like that, and the same technology that is replicable all over the world. So the competitive set is not the same. The positioning may be different. Most likely, the segments of the audience are going to be different from market to market, and not even from country to country, but also from state to state within the states, right? From region to region within Uzbekistan, because people are very different everywhere. These are the, I would say, key points. And then comes whatever the detail. The product has to be somehow adapted to the market, because when I was working on opening Papa John's in Azerbaijan, what we discovered, and it was quite sudden, nobody could tell us in advance, but suddenly we discovered that people in Azerbaijan don't like onion on their pizza. And how can you find this out? Because the competition is very young, was back in 11 years ago, was very young and quite honestly amateurial. And you come into these mom and pop's pizzeria and there's no onion on the menu. Okay, that could be a coincidence. But then we took this particular insight, particular observation, and started to question people, just random people. And people told us, yeah, indeed. Well, we never thought about it ourselves, but we wouldn't want to have on the pizza. And so we have a considerable change in the recipe where we had to replace onion with something else or remove it from most of the pieces. And we had to somehow explain it to the headquarters. It wasn't a very easy procedure, I would say so. But this is a very simple example of the product adaptation. But there's obviously more examples or more serious product adaptations, more thorough and extensions of the product than anything on many markets. So the product has to adjust to the market. No matter what, you can't have the very same product everywhere. The service style clearly adjusts to the market. Some markets are okay with fast casual type of service where you collect your own tray. Some markets are not. It depends on the audience. It depends on your positioning. It depends on the maturity of the market. It depends on the competition, of course. The look and feel of the store has to adjust. again, taking Azerbaijan as an example, we realized that at that time, and I'm sure it's more or less the same now, people were to value cleanliness and perfection in everything. So we needed to make sure that the storefront is shining all the time. Everything is perfect. Everything is clean. We serve only the best. It wasn't the porcelain. Yeah, best ceramic without any cracks or anything. It was important to the consumer. The store had to be larger than a typical store in the States or in Russia. There's a number of adjustments we also had to make. So these are the things that are typically adjusted when a brand comes into a different market. And it's very important to notice even the tiny, you know, in the pizza has to be noted before you start, because a tiny onion in the pizza can actually ruin your business if you don't understand. And even more so, most of the consumers won't be able to explain what's wrong.
Thank you so much for this detailed walkthrough. And I love the process, and especially the insight that in order to adopt both the brand and the product, you need to speak with your customer and your guests. Question on that. How do you research? How do you speak with the customers, with the guests, especially before you launch the concept or before you adopt the concept? What are the secrets there in doing the right research and asking the right questions to the right people in the right market?
I really love that question. And I love research myself. But I may not be right, academically right. I'm not an academic researcher. I believe in observation. And, you know, you have a number of research methods, focus groups, surveys, anything. But nothing works better than being open to understand. Being open to a weird piece of information that doesn't feel relevant at all. But then you start thinking about it and it takes you to a grand understanding of what is inside the consumer's brain. So I start absorbing a lot of information before we enter the market. When we approach the market, I start reading. I try to understand what's the structure of the market, how is segmented, what is popular, what is not, what are the concepts that are in the market already, what are the concepts that are not in the market, do they have fast casual already, or they still have the fast food concept with the hot deck, how does it work? First, I start to research the market in order to understand the general structure of it. Then, and that's quite crucial, is to understand the market from business perspective. So what are the rent charges and extra charges? What are the wages? What is the regulation for labor? What are the supply chain issues? There's a number of operational, organizational, and financial aspects around any particular market that can affect your business and your marketing and your brand and your economics altogether. So it's quite important to understand that before you start. And then as you come closer to understanding the structure, you start researching this particular segment and your particular competition. The first you understand who are the players, the key players on this market, it's very useful to, have an in-field researcher to help you with that, because there's a number of cases when the whole team is not able to travel and is trying to do this as a desk research. It doesn't really work as a 100% desk research. My experience of desk research is on international, on even regional markets, tells me you get yourself an idea, and then as you land, half hour later, the thing is completely different. So you have to have somebody in the field, at least someone to help collect the information, walk into those stores, collect the menus, try the food, give your feedback, make pictures of the crowd. In some markets, it's not. completely illegal to make pictures of people in the UAE. So researching the market, you won't be able to show the audience to your client. So collect as many insights as possible. And again, it's very important to listen and to be open to all sorts of information that comes into it. And then after we get this initial understanding of the market, as we get closer to understanding the market this way, then we prepare for the trip. And on the trip, we start talking with people. I usually start with the simplest, my circle, the people I know and the people they know. In my opinion, the more marketeers and the more people from the industry you have in the sample, the better, right? Because you get those professional insights along the real guests inside. I don't do too many interviews because most of the insights are already on the guest feedbacks online. You can have a 95% correct understanding of what the customer feels about this brand and product just by those reviews. So having those as a number of hypotheses, then we go on to interviewing the real guests, maybe 5, 6, or 7, to prove or somehow dig a little bit deeper into those hypotheses and understand what else do we have to research. And sometimes those lead us to looking into very unusual competitors. For your research in pizza category, and they say, well, but when people come get together and they have a party, they don't order pizza, they order something else. And then you go, let's research sushi. Yeah, or whatever. So they can guide you to a number of other things that you have to explore in order to understand how this thing works 360. And that's it.
I love the simple idea that you need to observe the market and the customers in order to get the insights. And I totally relate to that. I will share my personal story on observing for the UK market. When we hit the wall and understood that our concept, the pizza concept that we imported from Russia to the UK doesn't work, we were thinking whether you need to close the business or find a new positioning. And then we started to observe. The question was how to observe people at their homes in the natural environment and see how they actually order pizza without them knowing that you're observing. So what we've done, we actually were booking the rooms through Airbnb with the hosts, maximum for a week. And then after a few days, we were saying, look, I like you, you're a great host. Can I order you a pizza? But I don't know anything about ordering pizza. How can you advise me that? And then we were getting a lot of interesting insight, how they order pizza, where they get pizza from, what application do they use, whether they do it from restaurant or not. And this is exactly where we got the insight that people actually love restaurant-taste pizza, but they don't get it as great taste for delivery as it is in restaurant. And this is how we created the fast gourmet concept for the UK. So same approach, as you said, observation, and then insights, and then the positioning, and then the adaptation. Great. Let's talk about failures and surprises in a good adaptation. So I'm sure you've seen tons of brand failures in different markets when they entered and didn't adapt themselves enough. I just read an article about Starbucks in Vietnam. They couldn't crack Vietnam coffee market despite that Vietnamese drink a lot of coffee. And the truth behind why Starbucks cannot crack it is that Vietnamese, they love Robusta coffee. And Starbucks is actually making coffee from Arabic. And Vietnamese like very vivid taste of coffee. And Starbucks is just imported the American kind of style and way of coffee, which didn't correlate to the taste of Vietnamese. Share any of your experience of the brands that you worked or you've seen the failures when they entered the new market.
Would have failed in Italy, but they didn't. It's quite clear that Italians have a very strong traditional coffee culture, and it's all about espresso at the bar. The taste of the coffee is completely different to the American palate. Just moving into the market as a normal Starbucks brand, they would have failed. What they did instead, virtually they acquired a bakery brand called Princi in Milan, which was everybody's favorite bakery, cafe, aperitivo, and partnered with Princi in a Star Reserve Roastery experience as a touristic experience, a large unit with the roastery, with the bakery, with a number of different attractions, make a tourist attraction, and Milan is quite a touristic city, and the audience realize that they welcome the local product and the local culture and the local brand as a part. So these all experience massively, massively successful, and these helped Starbucks promote their brand in a right way on this competitive market. And they've had a number of cases. San Francisco, there's a brand called Boulangerie case when they needed to approach a highly competitive market of San Francisco in a better way with a better product. So they partnered with a bakery brand. There was a case with TGI Fridays that could enter the market in China as it is. It wasn't really the format, wasn't really understood. So this American style restaurant slash bar in a very casual and fun atmosphere welcomed by the audience, because the audience who could afford going to this kind of and having a drink for, you know, $10 were the posh kids. And the posh kids wanted something a little, you know, posh, where they could feel like royalty. So TGI Fridays had to reinvent as a little bit more premium with the ambience of a formal restaurant, with a little bit more formal service, complicated dishes, and that was more successful strategy as opposed to the previous one. And there's a fantastic case of McDonald's in Israel when they initially entered with their regular realized that it's quite enough to cater with the regular product to a large population of Israel without being kosher. But at the same time, they couldn't make all of their restaurants kosher because a larger number of population in Israel do not follow kosher. So situation, yeah, to solve. And they decided that some of the restaurants are going to be kosher and some aren't going to be not. Brilliant idea. Having adopted the product in some of the restaurants as kosher, they went to sign it off as a kosher restaurant to the rabbi of Tel Aviv, and the head rabbi said, I cannot do that because your brand looks the same on both displays. So that observant Jews confused. They wouldn't know which one is kosher. You have to adapt the brand, the color, the signage. And this has led to the most crucial adaptation of McDonald's ever. And in Israel, they have two types of signage, the normal signage for the regular stores and the blue signage for kosher stores.
Let's talk about technology, and especially how technology is now shaking up the way food brands adapt themselves into foreign soil. And I'm talking technology as a broad term. AI, of course, everybody's talking about AI. Does AI actually now helping the food tech or not? And maybe other examples of how technology enabling the faster adaptation of the food brands or restaurant brands into different markets.
Well, in fact, the level of technology in every market is different. And that's also a part of the presentation and the main concept on an international. If you're, you can't deal with chat, you know, that they buy things in WeChat, communicate and things. And this is something you have to very much familiar with. Some markets are more advanced technologically, like Russia, for the consumers are very digitally obsessed, very progressive. Some markets were in the Midwest, the UAE, it's techy, but it's not at the edge of technology. And there's some markets that are a little bit behind. And those are the markets that back in the old world, which is now not in terms of technology, the old world is more industry. Quite often, a lot of the companies in the state are there on on solutions that are not very modern. That is a crucial barrier for the international expansion for those brands, because they have their POS system, whatever, as a mandatory system for the international franchisees. But the internals are way more advanced already, and the markets are way more advanced. And what is the point of having an old-fashioned POS system, old-fashioned CRM system, when you can have a cheaper and better and a much more advanced product in your international? So this is probably the challenge for a lot of to serve. And also because a lot of fashion, their APIs is closed, so you can't really have many solutions out there. And that the world is based on open API and pre-integration with anything, cloud solutions, as opposed to service solutions. And this is the biggest, I would say, is not issue. It is more of a business system issue that a lot of companies have to resolve entering the international market. Is to be very much open to having maybe sometimes a number of POS solutions, because, you know, there's the powerful international markets that would be more efficient to work on their own solutions, local solutions, rather than international. And you cannot ignore, of course, is to business development nowadays, but is not as crucial as a, it doesn't have to be such a robust standard or product. Of course, is important to be able to source the data, to accumulate in one particular way, in one particular way, to work with database, to work with product. And I would say it should be more on the level of integration of different systems rather than trying to have everyone use this one.
Let's talk about Dubai and Emirates as the target market, because you spend there a lot of time and you actually help some brands to adapt to this market. What are the cultural peculiarities in terms of the brand, in terms of the audience, in terms of the taste preference product that food brands or restaurant brands need to consider when entering this market?
Oh, wait, which is very for the fast food and coffee. It's culturally not accepted to eat in public. So having someone drink a coffee out of a cup, sitting on a bench, it's super rare. Having someone, you know, with a pizza box in their hand, it's you wouldn't. So the street food format, as we know it, is not very common in the coffee to go is not very common. If people go out to eat, they go out, they sit down, they get some sort of service, and then they walk out of this restaurant or cafe without holding any. So with this, the takeaway is not that. Dubai, delivery, yes, of course, is one of the most advanced markets in terms of delivery, but it's heavily dominated by aggregators, even more than in the States or in Russia, and I believe so even more. Aggregators are everything in Dubai, and rarely anyone delivers by themselves. Maybe there's few companies, I know, but rarely. Of course, the Ramadan is massively affected in April. It's usually in April. People are not allowed to eat outside on the terraces, in the streets. And the Muslim population would only start eating after sunset. And most of the Muslim population would be eating after the sunset. It's called iftar. Again, in Dubai, the Arab population is only about 12%. There's a number of Muslim national ethnicities living in the country. It's here as I can live in the For instance, nobody would sit outside in the terrace at all. And this year, I could some municipalities allowing their cafes to still operate the terraces during Ramadan. That was quite usual. 2 years ago, no terraces allowed at all ever, and all the windows closed with some sort of day on the month of Ramadan. So it's evolving, and you know, more. But still, there's a lot. Every year, I guess, more European, but the consumer habits are quite strong in the market. Of course, there's only a small number of restaurants selling pork, and most likely you won't be able to get this license even month, because those are somehow issued in a very particular size for the particular. The alcohol is served in, not in the hotels, it's served in many places outside of the hotels right now. So it also keeps changing. Back in the days, it was just the hotel license and nothing. Alcohol, the tastes are sweet and spicy. So they like strong flavors. it's very different from the European taste. Whereas Europeans like to have their food very clean and natural in Dubai yet. But the market is moving quite European lifestyle and European tastes. So I guess...
Super. Maybe any other story from other markets that you want to share about how a food brand is actually adapted themselves?
Yes, in fact, there is a fascinating... 11 years ago, as a director of business development in the region, and I had to open the Azerbaijan market. So I came there as a part of the opening team together with some colleagues from UK and support on the opening of the store, support on the trainings, on understanding the model, et cetera, et cetera. So we spent like there training, working with the team, and our franchisee has hired a general manager for the store. And the general manager was 50-something person who never worked in an international environment, never spoke. He didn't want to wear the uniform because he didn't feel comfortable. He was to go out for a smoke every then. And he didn't want to learn how to use the system. Didn't care. Because there's a cashier, why would I, the general manager? And he would drink his coffee behind the counter every 25 minutes. So looking at this picture, and we had an amazing team of Yavin, looking at this picture of the general manager, the franchisees, you know what? This is not going to work. He told me, right, we have to have a senior male person in the store, you know, of the age to look and see as a serious institution. And I told him no. So basically, I questioned his understanding of the culture, and I was completely against this person in the system because the culture of the brand in this particular case was more important than his of some traditional way of doing business. And I said, you know what? The culture of the brand has to stay intact. And I do understand that this person wouldn't be able to work the way Papa John. It's just not this type of person. Let me fire him, I said. He was like, no. We have to have the general manager. So this conversation kept going for a good couple of days. And at some point, I was like, please, do fire him. You have a choice, him or me. If you fire him, I'm going to run the store. And I never ran my store myself. I've never did anything operational myself. And I told him, I'm going to run the store. I went, you know, and he said, okay, I choose you. And we fired this guy, and I start running the store. And running the store, we had this very weird situation when we were supposed to open tomorrow every day. So every day we were ready, getting ready to open tomorrow. And the next day, something went wrong. Wasn't, you know, put on the cash register. Something went wrong, the small, and we weren't opening. So the team was training every day to open tomorrow. Everybody was exhausted, and I couldn't let them go for a weekend for a couple of days or leave because we were to open tomorrow. And I realized if I let them go, I would most likely 100% lose a couple of people. So I had to keep them going for days and days and days. Everybody waiting not very, very well. So I had to keep them going and keep them motivated. And on the day of the opening, of the actual opening in the morning, we were tired, all of us. And I was, okay, I have to energize the team somehow and get them to understand that is the most important day and we have to win. So I thought, what can I tell the team to get them motivated? And I started understanding how this society works, and the society is quite hierarchic in Azerbaijan. There's a father on top of three family. There's the father that actually sets the rules, and everybody's working towards what he says is good. So, and then I look on the wall. Oh my God, John Snatter, the father, Papa John. Okay, and I started telling them a story about the father. So listen, team, today's a big day. And Papa John, John Snatter, is very happy and excited about us, you, opening the most beautiful store in the whole Papa John system of the 4,000 stores, believe me or not. And I have been to so many of them, of 4,000 stores, your store is the most beautiful. Okay. And guys and girls, John Snatter gave me a call this morning, or he did, and told me that tonight he's so happy that you are joining the family. It's a massive family of 92,000 people that we are joining together by opening the store. And tonight, John and his family are going together around the table and make a toast to your success and to fantastic future of Papa John's in Azerbaijan. And I get so driven by saying that. And the opening was fabulous. It was actually one of the best up in the history of the Papa John's system. And until now, Papa John's in Azerbaijan is of the best performing markets and the market that keeps the highest standards of the brand, of the product, of the quality, service, and performance. So this is the story. Somehow you have to adapt the philosophy.
Wow. What a great story. What I love from this story is that you initially had a clash between the brand values and the local traditions, and you actually made a very bold and very hard decision to choose the brand values on top of the local traditions. But at the same time, you acknowledged and took the local tradition of respecting the father and injected that to motivate the team and to make sure that everybody is energized by having the father himself recognizing that they're opening the store, which made them completely motivated when they were drained from the energy. That's a beautiful story. Ira, I think this is a perfect ending for our conversation. Thank you so much for being with me today. It's been very insightful and very useful. Thank you. Have a great day and good luck in your adventures.
Thank you for having me.